This lecture is actually the culmination of a whole period of research, as it has been mentioned, on the history of intellectual property in technology. And this started in 2007 when I was employed by Graham Goode, who is today here in Leeds, in a project called Owning and Disowning Invention. And we looked at the patent disputes in Britain in the electrical industry from 1880 to 1930. And this resulted in a book that will be out, a co-authored book that will be out next year, this period, or hopefully this period. So I would like to thank also Graham Goode, Professor Graham Goode, for letting me use some of the material from that book in this lecture. Thank him for influencing my historiographical approach. So this is the overview of the talk. I will start with an introduction of my historiographical, of the historiographical approach of this talk, and then move on the early years of wireless from the intellectual property perspective, and the third part, which is the main part, it is our own infringement, the patent rights, the debates about patents that occurred in Britain and in the United States. What is my historiographical approach, or the historiographical approach that I developed in collaboration with Graham, and what new it brings? Actually, I'm trying to either go beyond or supplement existing historiographies on wireless industry that emphasize on business strategies, on the importance of the economics of manufacture, or of the importance of R&D, of research and development activities by amateurs or by corporations. The emphasis is intellectual property, and I put it in inverted comma because intellectual property in back in late 19th century and early 20th century did not have the ideological connotations that has in our days. So I follow the intellectual property strategies of individuals, of corporations, of actors in the socio-technical regimes. My aim is to unravel the role, the performances of hidden actors, the role of expert witness, of judges, of lawyers. And this is influenced by the work that has been done by Seong-Guk Hong, who emphasized on the importance of John Ambrose Fleming in the making of the Marconi Company and the valve, and also Anna Guarnini. Anna Guarnini's approach, who emphasizes on the importance of patent agents in the making of the early wireless industry and the early patents of Marconi. I'm looking at the management of expertise and authorities, and I focus on issues of trust, credibility, on the spot, in the making, so whenever and wherever the patent dispute occurs. In that way, the law courts played and acquired an important role in this approach, and they began the public theaters of contestation. This is a historiographic approach that stresses the relational and the performative aspects of the inventorship, and I approach the wireless and the disputes, the patent disputes, as law, as technology, to use Biazzoli's term. So I'm looking at the co-production of law, of patents, of inventions, and the identities of the inventors by focusing on the law courts and emphasize on the culture that was constructed in the law courts or whenever or wherever the patents were disputed. This gives a very dynamic approach and a very dynamic approach in the intellectual property. And this approach someone can find if he looks back and how the contemporaries understood the way that decisions were made in the law courts. For example, Richard Webster, a very important judge of the early 20th century, he said that when he had to make decisions, what counts for him is to find the honest experts and to distinguish them from the mere advocates. So for those that had the partisans that had interests. In the same time, Fletcher Moulton, another judge, important judge of the early 20th century, said that for him what count was just the legal deduction, the reasoning and the arguments, the legal arguments as they were constructed in the cases. This dynamic context this dynamic context in the places where decisions were made in the law courts is revealed also in the public representations that occurred in either in lectures or in editorials in the contemporary technical press. For example, The Electrician, a major electrical technical journal of the period, in 1887, after a major patent dispute over the alternating current transformers of Goliard Gibbs, they said that the work of the judge was so difficult because all the matter was buried under the mountains of rhetoric. So rhetoric was make everything very difficult in the decision making. In the same 17 years afterwards, the secretary of the Institute of Patent Agents stressed the moral ambivalences that were inherent in the judicial procedures and questioned the trustworthiness of barristers, patent agents, and also the legal advisors. My historiographical approach is to see to unravel this dynamism and also to incorporate this in the historiography and unravel the hidden actors like barristers, judges, and expert witnesses. This is a list of inventors of the late 19th and early 20th century, and someone can see that there is no strict distinction between pure science and applied science. I mean, you can have William Thomson, who did a lot in pure science, but in the same time exploit his inventions and commercialize his research. And at the same time, you have Thomas Edison, Sebastian Ferranti, Guglielmo Marconi, and George Hookham, who were practical men, manufacturers, and all these contribute in the making of the inventorship of the late 19th and 20th century. So there was an inventing culture that emphasized the importance of patents. And all these figures, they were well immersed in this culture. But surprisingly, the early period, the early history of wireless, it was without patents. I mean, there was an attempt to establish an innovation pattern without patents. And this is an attempt that pursued mainly by Oliver Lodge, Alexander Popov, and Jagadish Bose, professor in India. For different reasons, they didn't claim any patents in the early period. For the first 3-4 years, from 1894 to 1896-7. What changed? in this story, it is the coming of Marconi in the UK. He's coming and he starts following a very multifaceted knowledge management strategy. Secrecy, limited disclosure, but also patent. He applied for a provisional UK patent in June 1896. He got the patent in March 1897. And with those patents, he sought the public funding and he sought contracts with UK Post Office and the Navy. And this was the main strategy to secure contracts with the post office and then to expand to the colonies. Marconi avoided litigation the first 13 years in the UK. This was not the same in the US, where he had to defend his intellectual property and his assets. But in the British context, he did not litigate any other inventor. And this strategy was even boosted further from the manager Cuthbert Hall. Who was the manager of the Marconi Company from 1903 to 1908. And Hall tried to avoid litigation and to secure exclusive contracts and informal monopolies. He believed that only in this way the Marconi Company can expand in the UK and also the British colonies. There was no litigation, but there was a concern about who will get the credit the credit of the invention of wireless. Because with the patent of 1897, I need to tell that this strategy changed with in 1909, the strategy of not litigating in the UK changed with the 1909 with the new managing director Isaacs that emphasized on the power of intellectual property and intangible assets and followed a strong management of intellectual property. So, as I said before, there was no litigation, but there was a concern about who would get the credit. And this was a concern of Oliver Lodes and Sylvanus Thompson. And Lodes believed that the attribution by Priest in his public presentation of the invention of wireless to Marconi was completely unfair, because he believed that Marconi introduced us improvement of what he had presented in his public lectures in the Royal Institution and here in Oxford in 1894. Also, Sylvanus Thompson believed that Sergian wireless was unpatentable. It was public knowledge. The same line followed by the editors of the electricians that believed that Marconi patent was invalid and his innovations were unpatentable and already contained in innovations introduced by Oliver Lodes. What Lodes and Thompson tried to establish was credit and establish a different narrative from the narrative that Priest provided, who placed Marconi at the center of the story of the invention of wireless. In this context should be viewed also the history of John Joseph Fahy, who wrote the history of wireless telegraphy from 1838 to 1899. What Fahy did was to, and this book was published in 1899, what Fahy did was to go back and give credit to major figures like Oersted or like Ampere, Faraday, and Maxwell in the making of the wireless. Placing Marconi along with Preece as those that contribute in establishing the first practical lines of wireless telegraphy. So what Parcel, what Fasci tried to establish was a historiography that challenged the commonplace of individualist and heroic narratives about Marconi and generally about the invention of wireless, and in the same time, but in the same time, provided very powerful arguments for those that challenge individual patents, challenge the individualist patent claims in the law courts. So, no litigation in Britain, and a huge concern about the attribution of credit, because the patent disputes was not only about securing a place in the market, it was about having having a capital, not financial only capital, but also a social and cultural capital. So credit was not only in terms of money, but also credit in terms of prestige and social status and securing the place in the history of wireless. In 1907, there was a decision in the United States against DeForest and in favor of Marconi, and it was William Townsend, the judge, who said that Marconi was the first to describe the first and the first to achieve the transmission of definite and intelligible signals by means of Hertzian waves. This was a discontinuous rewriting of the history of wireless telegraphy by the judge, by a judge, and in that way marginalized the attempts of other people, other protagonists like Lodge, or the contribution of other practitioners like Maxwell or Hertz. This discontinuous narrative of wireless existed later and boosted more by Marconi himself in the Nobel Prize lecture that he gave in 1909, and also in a pamphlet entitled Brief Story of My Life that was published in the American Marconigram in July 1913. And surprisingly, it was the autobiography, but it was not actually the autobiography. It was just the compilation of the evidence that that Marconi gave in a patent dispute in the United States against the National Electric Signaling Company. So there were competing narratives that someone is finding when look and go through detailed patent disputes and the transcripts of those patent disputes. As I said, there was no patent litigation up to 1910 in Britain. It was not the case in the United States. I will come back to that later. And it was Isaacs that changed the corporate strategy, and it was Isaacs that focused on developing a very strong knowledge management strategy. And for that reason, the Marconi Company started a legal action against the British Radio, Telegraphic and Telephone Company in December 1910 and lasted until February 1911. The important case was the infringement of the important 4-7 patent of Marconi. What the defendants argued, what the the British Radio, Telegraphic and Telephone Company argued was that the construction of the Marconi patent specification was not the correct one. The Marconi patent was anticipated by others, other inventors. That Marconi innovation lacked the status of patentable invention because it lacked subject matter. What Marconi did was that he took the ideas of others, put them together, introduced some common knowledge, and put it on the paper and write a patent. That was the third argument. And the fourth and very important argument was that in the specifications that was used by the British Telegraphic Company, the defendant specification introduced an autotransformer, while Marconi's specification introduced a transformer, a different circuit. And they, and I quote, "The defendant's device is an inductive chant, acting differently from a transformer, and that it was not known as an equivalent of a transformer at the date of the patent." That was the arguments of the defendants. How the other side, how Marconi reacted, was directed by this chap. The legal, who led the legal team, Sir John Mayer Asbury, an Oxford graduate who spent many years as a barrister in Manchester and London, and then in 1913, just after this case, became a judge. What was his strategy? The main strategy was to establish the case that Marconi did not only contribute in the making of the principles of wireless, in the theory of wireless, but the emphasis should be given in the fact that Marconi managed to build a workable technology. Workability and usability was the key and important issues in this patent dispute. And in that way, he says, look what Marconi did. He increased the transmission distance. Look what we have as a company. We have contracts. So these things work, and this work because of this patent, and this is the important usability, workability of the patent. What he moved a step further by distinguishing between discovery and invention. And he did that in order to give some space and acknowledgement to practitioners like Maxwell, scientists like Maxwell, Branly, and Crookes, and say, look, they have their share in the theoretical explanation, in the experimental explanation, but Marconi was the first to receive messages by using electromagnetic waves. So Marconi was the first who introduced workable techniques of wireless. They bring in order to support the argument, this chap, James Swinburne, a Scot, who, although did not have a formal engineering education, he was he became a very important authority with a huge practical experience in engineering issues and established an authority in the law courts. He had a high prestige as an expert witness. Swinburne's argument was that the important issue of Marconi invention, that it was that and achievement, it was that he introduced tuning and the use of a two independent circuit transformers. He said that, look, the Lodge's patent of 1897 was important and great advance because directed engineers and practitioners to the importance of syntony. But what Marconi did with the four patents was to supplement Lodge's innovations by introducing a closed circuit with a large capacity into Lodge's invention. And he said, look, I am the first who built autotransformers in order to attack the argument of the defendants. I am the first who built, so I know about how what an autotransformer was. And I can testify that the defendants was a two-circuit transformer, but not a two-independent circuit transformer. So the defendants had something different there, but the name transformer was loosely used in the wider and the narrow sense. So he said practically that the construction of the patent specification was in that way so to cover both. So it was not a big issue to raise in this patent dispute. Marconi Company bring in also as an expert witness Dougal Clerk, a patent agent and inventor that established with the Marx Clerk patent agency in Birmingham and then spread worldwide in, with offices in Manchester, London and New York, and major customers also from manufacturer world. So they bring in someone who read, who know, who has an authority to read the specifications and construct them, and also to define the meaning of technologies, not just one witness. In his testimony, he stressed this tuning, he emphasized that the innovation was tuning, the introduction of tuning of a closed oscillatory circuit to an open radiating circuit that Marconi introduced. Also said that Lodge's patent could not achieve what Marconi did, the chain of waves, and could not increase the energy up to the levels that were necessary to secure long-distance transmission. While attacking Brown's specification, he said that he introduced a method for long oscillation rather than trains of waves, and also that it was not informative enough to enable the modification of the apparatus, so it was not informative enough to facilitate replication that was very crucial in the making of patent specification and in their validation. The judge who judged this case was Lord Justice Parker, and he took he took the side of Marconi, and it is interesting how he constructed his verdict. Although the defendants they built also an experimental installation to prove the difference between both the difference as artifacts, as circuits, but also as function, their function, the difference between transformer and autotransformer. He neglected this, and Parker focused only on the expert witnessing and started to evaluate the testimony by Swinburne or Dougal Clerk. Parker's judgment was based on expert witnessing and giving credit on virtual witnessing, to use the term by Simon Saffer and Sapien, as inscribed in the patent specification. Parker treated also his verdict as a matter of storytelling, a historical narrative, rather than as a verification of experimental findings. If someone goes and look at the verdict, he will find a huge proportion of the verdict being a story, the history as of wireless as seen from Parker, giving credit to Henry, Helmholtz, Maxwell, Schertz, but not to introduce a collectivist approach as fashion, but in order to confirm the distinction that was introduced by the lawyers of Marconi, the distinction between discovery and invention. So again, it was built a narrative in order to introduce Marconi as someone who managed to overcome existing difficulties and build something workable. So Marconi patent was the first to introduce a practicable solution to existing problems. The defendant's apparatus contains essential, he said that the defendant's apparatus contains essential features of the inventions protected by Marconi. And also, he in the issue about the difference between transformer and auto-transformer, he said, yes, I can see the difference, but in my opinion, and I quote here, however, the use of two-coil instrument is not an essential feature of Marconi's invention at all. The merit of the invention lies in the idea rather than in the particular means by which he carries it out. And this was presumably a huge vindication for Marconi and robust his place in the British market. But Marconi as a company after the war was not that efficient in managing expertise and authorities. In one of the major post-war cases against the Mullard Valve Company, I need to say here that we are now in the period of valve. I mean, after John Ambrose Fleming had already invented the thermionic valve, Marconi transformed the thermionic valve into sensitive detector of wireless, and also Lee DeForest invented the three electrode valve, and then we have the two main branches, the two elements, and the three element patterns of inventions in wireless. So the case was about patents that Marconi company owned. It was Henry Joseph Round patent about improvements in receivers for the use in wireless telegraphy, and the patents by Perry and Biquet about describing innovation to improve the mode of mounting the three electrodes in the valves to facilitate mass production. It was against Mullard Company, who manufactured Mullard valves. And Mullard valve was a hard valve which contains a grid in the form of a loose, open-ended cylinder placed around a hottest place, around the hottest place part of the filament. Mullard valve was a hard valve. That means that it was evacuating the highest degree in order to avoid ionization. The defendant's arguments, and finally who won the case, was that Round's patent was not novel. That you can find his innovation and inventions in the patents of Fleming, of DeForest, of Bayer, of several specific inventors. Perry's patent also was nothing more than a design, a combination of existing knowledge and methods of achieving a cheap and convenient method of manufacture. And they based their arguments on the testimony of Henry William Eccles, a doctorate from the Royal College of Science and an authority in electronics in the post-war Britain. Eccles' testimony stressed the linguistic ambivalence of Round's patent specification, particularly the term, and I will come back to this, of electrically closing, the term electrically closing that it was introduced in the plaintiff's patent, and provide a more restricted meaning and merit to Round's patent, and made a clear distinction between Bayer's and Muller's in order to give the originality, or to stress the original elements of Muller valves. Marconi decided to go and have as a witness someone from an insider, we can say, someone who was with the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company since 1899 and up to 1999, and at that moment of the patent dispute, it was consulting work as a consulting consulting engineer for the company. It was John Pletz. Pletz, in his testimony, he said that, look, the important issue is to show that the workability, the importance of round valve. And he contributed the experiment that he conducted and proved that there was a substantial, something substantial that the round valve introduced in the wireless and in solving the problems of loss and electron leakage. And building on those experiments, he moved a further step, arguing that what Fleming and von Baggers and DeForest introduced as innovation were very different from Round's valve, both in construction but also in the function and the effects that they bring. It worked for Marconi? No. As I said, Marconi lost this case, and the important issue for the judge who did this, who decided this case, Justice Lawrence, was the term electrically closed. He believed that this term was given by plaintiffs an unnatural meaning. The plaintiffs did not understand and interpret correctly Round's patent specification, particularly the expression that a grid formed a closed cylinder completely surrounding the filament. She believed that the grid in the Mullard valve is not in the form of a closed cylinder, as the plaintiffs argued, completely surrounding the filament, and this fact is was sufficient to prevent the Mullard valve from being an infringement, although it contains a hot filament and a cylindrical anode. Going to looking at the Paris patent, he argued that this patent differed from Mullard's valve in nearly every case, from the shape and the arrangements claimed in Paris patent. And on those arguments, he judged against the Marconi company. And as I said, after the war, Marconi company was not that efficient in managing experts and authorities. What was going on in the same period in the United States? As I said, in Britain, they did not, in the first 10 years, they decided not, 13 years actually, the Marconi company decided not to pursue any patent litigation. On the other side, on the other side of the Atlantic, they had to do that. And the very early case was not in the court, but in the United States Patent Office. And why in the United States Patent Office? Because in the United States you have a different patent law that, at least until 1905, in Britain there was no examination process, or at least thorough and strict examination process. While in the United States, when people filed for a patent, there was a strict, a whole procedure of examination of the validity of the patents. And practically, when the examiners understood that there was an issue of infringement there, they started a whole procedure of identifying who was the first inventor. So there was a case of interference between Guglielmo Marconi and
Reginald Fessenden and Harry Shoemaker.
The key invention, although there were several interference cases, and this lasted, the consideration of those in the patent office lasted for many months in 1903, the key invention, then the key issue, was the introduction of hysteresis magnetic receiver by those inventors. Those are the list of patents that by Marconi, Shoemaker, and Fessenden, and what it they were, or how, under what interference procedure they were disputed around 1903. Let me give some bios of those two inventors, American inventors, Shoemaker and Fessenden. Shoemaker was an American inventor from Pennsylvania. He was a professional inventor, and by 1905 he had already 40 patents in wireless telegraphy and radio, and also since then he was chief engineer in many companies in the U.S. Fessenden was a naturalized American citizen born in Quebec, Canada. He started as a chief tester of Thomas Alva Edison and as chief chemist later of Edison, and was started to his career as professional inventor, and he started his career to capitalize on his inventions once he found Walker and Given, who invested money on his inventive activities. Guglielmo Marconi, he had to go to the United States and defend his position, or the position of his patents, in the patent office. So he gave evidence, he gave testimony in the patent office. And the aim was to establish his priority of the idea, but also because of the patent law and the relevant clause, he had also to establish not only that he had the idea, that he conceived the idea of this particular receiver, but also that he made it work and made something practical from this. The argument was that, look, I had this idea in December 1901. I disclosed this idea to Kemp, and since then I disclosed this idea to several other people in the United States and also in Britain. And in between this period, I had also some British and foreign patents, but not U.S. patents. He brought also his pocket book, the notebook, to prove all his research activities and his ideas. He brought the British patent, also the several papers that he gave in between the idea, the conception of the idea, and the first patents, or after the first patents. And also he submitted to the patent office several reports and articles from contemporary technical press and journals. But the key issue is that he had the idea in December 1901, and he disclosed that day, the 10th of December, to Kemp. So Kemp, his assistant, collaborator, for 36 years, he had to come to, he had to go to the United States and give also testimony. The issue at stake in his testimony was to prove that he had recorded and in an accurate way the past event and can reproduce them again in an accurate way. And also He had to establish himself as someone who was trustworthy, and although he was not an electrical engineer, and someone trustworthy in electrical engineering matters. And I will, this will be clear in a bit. So, in the interrogation, he was asked whether he kept a diary regularly, and the answer was yes. And then he was asked about the conversation. What was the conversation that day with Marconi? And he said the substance of the conversation was to make the magnetic field in the magnetic detector detector movable, either by moving the core by clockwork or by some other means, or revolving a magnet. So he revealed the discussion with Marconi. But then this triggered the reaction of the other side. Practically, they said, who are you? I mean, what are you? And they said that, okay, you say so, but do you really understand? Because you are just a skilled operator. And he reacts by saying that, I don't think that I should be classed as an operator. In making stations for Mr. Marconi, I have had to command and direct as many as 60 men. I think that this is far above the position of an operator. And following other questions, he said that I have had constant work with Mr. Marconi as his assistant since 1896. So he worked, he understands, he knows about electrical engineering. He might not be the theoretician, but he said that I understand sufficient of the theory to fit up and work the apparatus, but not perhaps in the phraseology of an electrical engineer. The Marconi company wanted a local expert. They wanted to mobilize the authority of someone that could talk with an established authority, and they found it in the face of this chap, Charles Cross, who was professor in physics and director of the Rogers Laboratory of Physics in the MIT, and played an important role in establishing electrical engineering in MIT. And Cross was always very keen to link research and development in the corporate setting with his laboratory practices. And that's how in the early period of telephony, Alexander Graham Bell ended up in his laboratory, conducted experiments that facilitate the invention of telegraph and telephony. So Cross testimony, in his testimony, Cross argued that he has the credential to talk, and he was a trustworthy expert because of he is an established physicist and an educator in electrical engineering. He has extensive and complete theoretical and experimental study of the phenomena, and also he has a huge and very considerable experience as experts in court and patent disputes in telephony, dynamo machinery, and telegraphy. Cross's testimony focused on Shoemaker arguments and devices, and he said that from what I have looked and inspect, it was that these devices are inoperative. I don't believe that they would be operative under any conditions which would make them of the slightest use as a receiver in wireless telegraph system. There is obviously no indication in this device of any of the figures relating or any of the figures relating to it which would in any way reveal the operation of hysteresis. What Shoemaker believes that his device is doing is not the issue at stake in this patent dispute, because what the device is doing and where the device is based was based on the magnetization of a magnetized bar, and this was completely different from what Marconi's device is doing. Fessenden and Shoemaker tried to argue that experimentation of Marconi was conducted abroad, so it doesn't count, it didn't count, but it was a very faint argument. That they had a long and established research interest in wireless along the lines of the inventions that they were talking in at that moment in the patent office, that they both had theoretical and technical understanding of the problem and the technicalities of the invention under debate, that they had developed a practical solution to the problem of the transmission of signals, and that they could prove their priority in conceiving and solving the problem. If we focus, let's say, for the sake of to save some time, only in the arguments of Shoemaker, in the testimony that he gave in May 1903, he said that, look, I conceived the invention well before Marconi. Marconi was December 1901. I can go back to August 1900. I did at that moment a drawing. I made some days afterwards a model. I disclosed my invention right from the late August and reduced my invention to something practical by September. And all this has been done without knowing any of the research that Marconi did. In order to prove this, one of the evidence that he gave was the notebook. Okay, I can prove August 1900, and he gave he gave the a diagram, a sketch that he did at that moment. And if you see, the sketch does not bear at the end only his name, but also the name of his assistant, who at that moment, in order to secure the priority, even in the notebook, he signed the name in order to specify that this sketch was done back in summer of 1900. Also, Shoemaker went even further, accusing Marconi via his business partner, Kechering, that Marconi stole his ideas, because Kechering, who was the manager of the American Wireless Telegraph and Telephone Company, had visited Marconi and had talked to Marconi. And this argument raised concern and also reaction from the Marconi legal team, who tried to deconstruct the expertise and the trustworthiness of Gehring, whether Gehring could translate and deliver this kind of information from the original inventor to another inventor. He did not have the credential and also the theoretical and practical understanding of wireless in order to transfer this information, and this information to be the appropriate information for the replication of the device. And himself, Guglielmo Marconi, said that, okay, I acknowledge he came, we met, but it was just 20 minutes. And this, in 20 minutes, it's so technical, this issue, that it was impossible to deliver this kind of information, and mainly the meeting was about business matters rather than technical and about inventions. And this is a table that I compiled by reading very closely all these transcripts, and how the dates that that the three inventors gave in terms of conception, the drawing, the disclosure, the model, when they built the model, and when the model became a working device. Marconi won all the four interference, and the reasons were that in terms of Fessenden did not manage to establish a priority due to incomplete evidence, did not provide a lot of evidence, or submitted undated sketches. Fessenden also witnesses did not manage to establish their trustworthiness and their expertise in mastering technical knowledge and information and devices. Shoemaker also, it was clear from the during the process of the examination that Shoemaker, there was a gap between the conception. Shoemaker could let's say establish that he first had something there, but up to deliver a practical, a workable device, there was a gap that came, Marconi came and filled that gap with his inventive activities, and Marconi exercised great diligence in embodying the invention into practical and commercial form, and the record establishes, the examiner said that the record establishes that at least as early as April, the 27th of April 1902, he had successfully used his magnetic detector in long distance signaling with the entire satisfactory result. So Marconi could have the whole package. Conception and a practical device, something that Fessenden could not establish for sure, but Shoemaker also had lost, could not also establish. And furthermore, Shoemaker could not even, did not define it, could not, Shoemaker's patent. As well as Fessenden patent could not establish a real, a concrete definition of the hysteresis magnetic receiver. So even their patent specifications were not well written and well constructed. So Marconi won this the four interference and boost his place in the American market, and his place boosted even further after winning this case against the American DeForest. It was a case about Marconi's U.S. patent in the 1913. This was a patent about a spark gap transmitter and receiving station with no tuning at all. The transmitter used a Rampkopf coil, Morse key rotary spark gap, and receivers used a coherent detector. It used various earlier techniques and instruments of various other experimenters, primarily Tesla and Popov, and this was explicitly stated in the patent specification. So it was a case of infringement,
And Marconi accused that the DeForest Wireless Telegraphy Company sold 4 sets of wireless telegraphy apparatus in the United States Signal Corporation that infringes the patent, the 11913 patent. Key figure in this patent disputes in the law court now, the U.S. law court, was John Ambrose Fleming. Consultant already in the Marconi company, but he was deaf. So he almost never went to the law courts himself. So there was a committee, and Fleming had to answer questions in his laboratory in London. In his testimony, Fleming tried to establish as a trustworthy and expert and an authority in wireless. He said that Marconi patent was a useful form of Hertzian form of wireless for long distance transmission. It was a combination of devices and innovation that worked together as telegraphic appliance. The patented innovation was original, and he said that Zolbier patent was not defendant said that Marconi's patent was already existed in other patents like Dolbear, Edison, or Kitty patent, and he said that Dolbear patent was not practical and useful, and also Edison patent was operative only in small distances, and Kitsi patent did not provide a practical or useful form of apparatus. And also accused or attacked some of the witnesses of the other side, among of them, for the evidence that they gave, among of them, Shoemaker, for not providing a fair understanding of and evaluation of the patents. yes. The defendants wanted and managed to secure scientific authorities to give evidence in the law court. The first was Cyrus Fogg Brackett, who was a professor of physics and founder of electrical engineering in the Department of Princeton University. And the second important, their second important witness was Arthur William Wright, who was the Yale professor of physics and someone who gave emphasis on laboratory and experimental practices. What both witnesses argued was that, in the words of Wright, that it seems to me, Wright said in his testimony, that the two systems are fundamentally different in construction, operation, and results, and resemble one another only in the fact that both make use of electric well in their operations. The defendants went a step further by accusing Fleming and trying to deconstruct Fleming's trustworthiness by saying, by comparing Fleming's statements in his book, The Principle of Electric Wave Telegraphy, with his testimony. And I quote from them, from the how their legal team approached the issue. And they said that the fact that Fleming omits in his book to state that defendants' system act like two separate parallel aerials connected together at the top indicate that such is not his belief. The fact that he omits in his affidavit to state the distinctions as he does in his book shows that he has not submitted the whole truth as he knows it. They tried all these tactics. They bring in scientific authorities, American scientific authorities, but with no effect because the patent specification was very strong, and Lee DeForest lost one more patent case. So, to conclude this talk, as I said well in the early part of the talk, an attempt to innovate without patents in the wireless was very difficult because of the market pressures and the competition, and there the role of Marconi and the agency of Marconi's knowledge management and tactics was very important to trigger a more proprietary approach to wireless knowledge and science. Marconi company was characterized by a multiplicity of knowledge and management strategies. In the dynamic setting of law courts, expertise is a relational attribute. Legal disputes are the setting for discontinuous historiographical approaches and narratives. Rigorous patent examination process provided the setting for priority battles and developed a stronger discourse over the issue of priority. The performative historiographic approach that I of the relation of technologies and law provides a rich and comprehensive understanding of the co-production of technologies and legal culture. If we looked at expert witnesses, background and biographies, we can say that authorities, scientific authorities, all the mobilization of the scientific authorities was important, but also there was in the patent issues also the issue of practicality and practicability and workability, so the issue to bring in figures with more practical oriented engineers and figures with practical experience, and there was a diversity and heterogeneity of trust relations in authority, and there the management of witnessing played an important and key role in the making of wireless patent disputes, and in that way in the making of wireless, or at least in the making of the Marconi contribution in the wireless industry. And with this, I would like to thank you for being here and listen to me. I'm open to your question. And once more, I would like to thank the Bodleian and the science, the History of Science Museum, for all the support in this project. This lecture could not have been written without this support, and it is based, as now you can see, exclusively on Marconi collection. This makes it a little bit vulnerable in terms that I did not have access to American archives, which is the next step, but I believe that Bodleian and the Bodleian gave me a great chance to have access to a fantastic collection. And with this, thank you very much. Once more.